some men to carriages aspire, on some the costly hansoms wait. Some seek a fly, on job or hire, some mount the trotting steed elate. I envy not the rich and great, a wandering minstrel, poor and free. I am contented with my fate, an omnibus suffices me. In winter days of rain and mire, I find within a corner straight. The busmen know me and my lyre, from Brompton to the Bullen Gate. When summer comes, I mount in state the topmost summit, whence I see Croesus look up, compassionate, an omnibus suffices me. I mark untroubled by desire Lucullus's phaeton and its freight, the scene whereof I cannot tire, the human tale of love and hate. The city pageant early and late unfolds itself, rolls by to be a pleasure deep and delicate, an omnibus suffices me. Princess, your splendour you require, I, my simplicity, agree, neither to rate lower nor higher, an omnibus suffices me.
Welcome to another edition of School of Poetry, a poetry podcast brought to you by Loughborough University, where we celebrate the exciting world of poems and poets, the great and the not so great. This episode, our focus is on transport. I'm Dr. Oliver Turl, lecturer in English at Loughborough University, and I'm delighted to be joined by two of my colleagues who are actually making a return visit to the School of Poetry podcast today. Dr. Sarah Parker is a lecturer in English with a research specialism in 19th and early 20th century literature, with an emphasis on women's writing, poetry, decadence and aestheticism, gender and sexualities, and visual cultures. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
And also joining me today on the podcast is Dr. Andrew Dix, lecturer in American Studies, whose research interests include African-American culture, 20th and 21st century US fiction, film adaptation, Hollywood stardom, and cinema and globalisation. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello, thank you.
And indeed, welcome back to both of you. I'm delighted to have you back for this episode all about poetry, moving poetry, we might say. Moving in maybe more than one sense. Poetry all about transport, which you may think, are there many poems about forms of transport? Well, we opened today's podcast with one such example. That poem that you heard at the beginning of the show was Amy Levy's Ballad of an Omnibus, read by Sarah. And Sarah and I know you teach this poem to your students, so what can you tell us about Levy's poem?
Ah, well, okay, so I've got lots to say about this poem, and as you say, Ollie, I discuss it a lot with students. I suppose one of the things I'd like to sort of start with really is the sound of the poem, which I hope came across in my reading. It's a bouncy number, this one. So it is indeed a ballad, but it's not the ballad form that we might necessarily think of, the four line quatrains of a traditional ballad. It's actually a ballad with an E on the end.
Ah, yeah. So what difference does that E make?
So it's this old French form, apparently, that kind of became much more popular at the time that Levy was writing. And it has these very kind of complex rhyme structures. So it's actually they're eight line stanzas, double the length of a standard ballad stanza, or octaves, I should say. And the rhymes, as far as I know, it's A B A B B C B C. What matters about this is that it's got this very kind of bouncy, melodic, rhythmical, sort of skippity doo sound to it. Which, when we think about what it's actually about, the fact that this is about, you know, somebody who's really enjoys riding on an omnibus, a form of transport, of course, that we don't necessarily use very much today. But it's all about that enjoyment of a rather kind of rickety ride around London, across the entirety of London. So something I try and get students to see is, or to indeed hear, is that pleasure and that movement is captured in the sound of the poem itself.
Absolutely, yes. No, it's a really good example of form, you know, reflecting the content, what the poem is telling us.
Exactly.
The rhythms of this journey. And yeah, omnibus, I suppose, you know, we get our word bus from omnibus, but an omnibus was a kind of a horse-drawn Victorian, an early 20th century mode of transport. So it's kind of, but it was used by, you know, quite a few people at once. It wasn't a kind of a private carriage.
Yeah, exactly. It was a commuter system of the time. Mm. But the interesting thing to say about this, though, is that that for women to ride on an omnibus, it was much more normal to actually ride inside the omnibus on the lower levels. So you were kind of hidden from the public view. But of course, from your perspective as a rider, your view of the city was also kind of compromised by being in that position. So what Levy's speaker here is saying is that she wants to sit on the top of the omnibus, which was the kind of open bit. Lots of people like to sit at the front on the top of the bus these days.
Yes,
I certainly do. You know, push the kids out the way. that's my seat, the best view. And it's a similar idea, but the omnibus would have been open at the top. So it meant that on the one hand, the as you can hear here in the poem, you know, the speaker is saying how they can see the city unfolds itself to them. But the scandalous thing was that as a woman, that also put you on quite public display. Mm. And some of her kind of biographers say that Levy was actually one of the first women to ride on top of the omnibus. And so there could be a kind of biographical link here that she was somebody who kind of pushed boundaries and was pioneering in so many ways. And one of these ways was that she wasn't willing to compromise her enjoyment as a viewer and as a flaneur or flaneurs, a wanderer in the city.
Yes, yeah. And it's very interesting, the idea omnibus, I mean, literally kind of for everyone, isn't it? For all, isn't it, this idea. So, I mean, how kind of universal would the use of an omnibus be at this time? Is there a... Because she's very interested in the rich and the poor and money and wealth and things that come into the poem quite a lot.
I mean, this is certainly a time that in late 19th century London, there's a lot more mingling of different class groups and obviously across gender as well. So this really is the kind of the era where people are rubbing shoulders through travelling on an omnibus, but also, you know, you've got things like actually the tube. Although those things seem shockingly modern to us, actually, you know, this is really that era where there is a lot more opportunity for those kind of encounters across various identities. I really like the line neither to rate lower nor higher, because it's also a pun on that idea of whether you're traveling on the, you know, the top layer or the bottom layer. And you know, this form of transportation was quite a democratic one, really. Again, you know, you've got these other modes of transportation being mentioned in the first stanza there, a fly or a phaeton, different kinds of carriages where you would ride, you know, as an individual or in a smaller grouping, and those would be signs of, you know, having the wealth to afford to do so. But this speaker's saying, no, what I want is actually this quite lowly form of transportation that's affordable, because it actually gives me this great perspective where I can kind of muck in with the city, but also have enough distance to be able to take it all in.
Yeah, and it is very upbeat, isn't it? It's very, you know, and you get the jauntiness and the bounciness, as you say, of the meter there as well, to kind of reinforce that. And you mentioned the tube, and I'm just thinking about modernist poets writing about riding in the tube, you know, imagists like Richard Aldington and F.S. Flint. It's a much darker and more kind of pessimistic view of that kind of communal travel, but here it seems to be a lot more positive.
I mean, that's true, but actually in the archive recently in Los Angeles, I just want to drop that in there, I actually came across a poem by Dolly Radford, who's writing around the same time as Levy, but this poem was actually early 20th century, and it's called Love on the Tube. And it's a comical ditty about, you know, that kind of rush hour crush moment. So it is interesting, that there's a tradition of this kind of poem that actually does continue into, you know, 1910s, 1920s as well.
Yeah, so what is the date of this poem?
So this one is from Levy's last collection, which was A London Plane Tree and Other Verse, which was published in 1889. So just before that kind of 1890s fin de siècle moment, Levy sadly actually died at the age of 27. She committed suicide as a result of she was inhaling charcoal fumes, and that really became what she was remembered for, rather than her poetic achievements. She was an incredibly talented poet.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, this writing about the city, this. It's obviously something that, going back to what we were saying about the tube, you get a lot more of in 20th century poetry. And I know, Andrew, you've brought along two very kind of different examples of transport poetry. Thinking about the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes, we've got a poem, Florida Road Workers.
Yes, I think the two poems I've brought along, perhaps in... opposition really to Sarah's choice, would better be described as anti-transport poems, quite resistant from different perspectives to the kinds of transport that they're describing. So yes, the first poem from 1930 is by Langston Hughes, who, as you were saying, Ollie, is one of the best known writers of the Harlem Renaissance, that explosion of African-American creativity across a range of art forms from the First World War onwards. Hughes, in his poetry, as you know, often took on a range of personas and speakers and characters, rather than speaking usually in a direct lyrical voice. So in this one, he's ventriloquizing one of the Florida road workers from 1930. So I'll just read this one. Hey, buddy, look at me. I'm making a road for the cars to fly by on, making a road through the palmetto thicket for light and civilization to travel on. I'm making a road for the rich to sweep over in their big cars and leave me standing here. Sure, a road helps everybody. Rich folks ride, and I get to see 'em ride. I ain't never seen nobody ride so fine before. Hey, buddy, look, I'm making a road.
Yes, yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, you say anti-transport, so, you know, what kind of themes is Hughes bringing in here? He writes in a number of different persona, but is he drawing on his own experience, do we know? Is he drawing on people he knew?
Not particularly his own experience, because although he often, again, picking up on what Sarah was talking about, Levy's democratising aesthetic, Hughes was very often drawn in his own work to taking on the personae of people on the margins, sort of criminal, outcast, impoverished, subject, of course, to the structural racism of the period. But he himself was from sort of slightly more comfortable circumstances than that, very much sort of steeped in, I suppose, quite a high aesthetic tradition at this point. So, so he's not speaking out of any direct road building experience, but I guess out of that empathy with those. I suppose there's nothing actually in this poem that foregrounds its racial implications, but if you think about signs of African American vernacular forms, as in the double or even the treble negative towards the end of the poem, the sort of condensed endings with ing turn to IN, quite familiar features of Black English. And so it's a fair assumption, I think, particularly bearing in mind sort of Hughes's work more broadly, that this is an African-American speaker.
And yeah, class and race, yes, therefore come into the... I'm making a road for the rich to sweep over in their big cars.
Yes. It struck me actually, comparing this with his poem I Too, which was written only a few years earlier, which was much more optimistic about the potential for African Americans to be sitting down with white Americans, using the metaphor of the table, of a shared meal, shared brotherhood, and so on. Whereas this one, there is that sense of division, hierarchy. The speaker reduced to really the position of the impoverished spectator as the privileged sweep by.
I mean, I'm thinking about 1930 as well. Was this published in 1930? Was it written kind of, you know, against the backdrop of the Great Depression and the Wall Street crash?
Yes, I mean, it was written in 1930 and published in a US newspaper. at that time. I suppose this is the beginnings of depression. So maybe it actually comes out of a period of expansion, actually, in American road building, which, of course, would subsequently and quite soon sort of run into problems as the Depression took hold. But no, I think this would probably be a slightly pre-Depression poem in terms of its historical moment.
Mm. Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, going back to Levy's poem, you do have, you know, rich and poor, these kind of divisions, these this sense of the kind of social hierarchy and the differences between classes and people living in the same society. But he's really, you know, writing about this. It seems quite an impassioned kind of poem about these divisions, rather than with Levy, kind of, you know, that much more upbeat and contented.
It's a bit it's a bit belated because we've moved away from Levy, but I did want to just say that we don't actually hear anything particularly about the passengers in that poem, do we?
Yeah, that's true, and there is a sense of superiority in the poem from those not really mentioned passengers. One thing I just wanted to say was that very often students puzzle over the refrain, "An omnibus suffices me." Mm. The word "suffices" doesn't exactly, it kind of has at least a double meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah.
More potential meanings than that, but there is a sense that it's not much, but it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
But also that perhaps there's a creeping doubt in there that maybe it's not even enough. So I think there's a criticism in there, I think, as well as a overall bouncing positivity. There's a bit of doubt, I think, too.
Especially with the repetition of it, because it's like the villanelle, the form where you have the kind of the two repeated lines. Mm. And one of the things that, you know, you get in poets who write villanelles is an attempt to make you start to question the sincerity or the conviction behind that phrase. So you get a phrase that actually changes meaning throughout the poem. And I'm wondering whether we'd leave it. Yeah, we're supposed to, "I'm contented with my fate, and omnibus suffices me." You think, yes, you know, very sort of satisfied with that. But by the time you get to the end, you know, you're wondering, you know, does the lady protest too much?
Exactly.
So we've had omnibuses from the 19th century. We've talked about tube travel. We've talked about the underground, and we've had, of course, the road building, in the United States. And I mean, cars. You know, I mean, there was a lot of poetry in the 19th century, in particular about railways when they were new. There was Wordsworth's famous kind of plea to protect the Lake District against the planned building of the Kendal to Windermere Railway in 1844. And he wrote to Gladstone, who was a minister in Robert Peel's government at the time, to kind of, make a case for not despoiling the beautiful Lake District with a railway. And so you get quite a few railway poems. We get poems towards the end of the century about the omnibus, this new kind of sort of democratic way of travelling. But cars, you know, it's obviously, cars have been around since the sort of turn of the 20th century. And how many great poems about cars are there, you know? But Andrew, you've suggested a rather striking poem.
Yes. I suppose if the Hughes mood was sardonic and satirical and disenchanted with regard to car travel, this next choice is actually apocalyptic, about the dangers of a car culture. So this is an extract from Autogeddon, first published in 1987 by Heathcote Williams. I don't know about you two, but I first came across Heathcote Williams not as a poet, but as the actor who played Prospero in the 1979 Derek Jarman adaptation. it's a very good film. It's very very worth watching. A very, very striking adaptation. So he played Prospero in that. He was also in the adaptation of Orlando, so you might have seen him in that.
Oh wow, yes. I'll have to go back and have a look.
He's got a smaller role in that than he has in The Tempest. And he was something of a modern Renaissance man, because he was a dramatist, a pamphleteer, very involved in a whole series of political campaigns. He was also later on a painter, sculptor. He was a magician. And not least, he was a fire eater. And actually, this seems very bizarre, but he was taught fire eating by Bob Hoskins, the well-known actor of that period. And another, perhaps the last of the fire eating tales with him, he actually, equipped with that new skill, he once accidentally set himself on fire in front of his then girlfriend, the 1960s model Jean Shrimpton.
So
all of that is by way of colourful and fairly irrelevant background, but
it's whetted our appetite for his poetry now, you know. Amazing roll call of sort of talents there.
So Autogeddon then is a long poem. As I say, it was first published in a more condensed form in a radical magazine in 1987. And then it was subsequently expanded in 1991 into book form in a volume that also had photographs of sort of motor destruction and damage caused by a car culture. And it was also adapted in that year by the BBC with Jeremy Irons actually reading the poem. So I'm going to fall, well short of... of Jeremy Irons, but shall I read you?
Oh, yes, please. Yes. Give us
so, as I say, this is a poem of several hundred lines in length, so I've just really chosen about 30 or so. Look out of any city window. Cars will slice through your thoughts and take them away for nothing. Stand in any street, bristling with painted piranhas, playing the flatulent, whining muzak of stress. And be forced to absorb their every willful manoeuvre, a mass-produced multiple sword of Damocles inexhaustibly hovers over every action. Streets that were open universities are now the open sewers of the car cult. But if all this proves too overwhelming, you have permission to take it out on anyone you wish, including yourself, with a relaxing impunity. The visitor follows up the court reports. Hit someone over the head with a chrome fender and kill them? Life. Take the precaution of attaching the chrome fender to a car. Hit someone over the head with it and kill them? 6 months suspended. License briefly withheld. I'm going to democratise the automobile, said Henry Ford. And when I'm through, everybody will be able to afford one. And about everybody will have one. It's a very apocalyptic poem in places. It begins actually even as early as its fourth line in recording the 17 million fatalities caused even at that point in an estimation by a car culture and economy. I suppose it has a variety of moods, sometimes sardonic, but I think sometimes, as I say, perhaps ramping up to that apocalyptic mood.
Is there a kind of, knowing more about the poem as a whole, is there a sense of fascination, though, as well, against his better judgment, with the power of the car, as well as its destructiveness? Yeah. There's also a real interest in the phenomenon.
I think there is, actually. I mean, as a subject, it does give him energy. I mean, there's that repulsion from it. But it also does prompt a great deal of creativity. A whole series of different images and so on generated by cars. You know, we just had a few of them there. Painted piranhas, for instance.
Yeah. I like the pun on inexhaustibly. Yeah, inexhaustibly hovers over a reaction.
The voice is quite sort of instructional, which is interesting, isn't it? It's sort of telling you, it kind of sounds to me a bit like an advertising voice almost. But obviously what it's encouraging you to do is to commit murder with your bits of car.
You'll get away with it. It's the reason I asked about the fascination is that you say there's a lot of energy derived from thinking about the car, the power of the car. And I hadn't really seen that in poetry. great deal, but obviously writers of fiction have explored that a lot, and the person who came to mind was somebody who wrote a lot about Armageddon and Apocalypse, but also about the fascination with the automobile, the car, which is J.G. Ballard.
Yeah.
And we started with Amy Levy's Ballard, and we went to a different, very different Ballard now. So there's got to be a terrible pun in every podcast. Yeah, obviously, you know, he wrote Crash, which was turned into the David Cronenberg, adapted into the film by David Cronenberg. When he sent that book, which is obviously all about the kind of fetish of the car and car accidents, the wounds, the destruction that cars can inflict. One publisher said, you know, the author of this book is beyond psychiatric help. Yeah. And there is this kind of curious psychological fascination, but also a repulsion, I think, you know, with the car. Mm. And I think Williams really kind of seems to be exploring that here.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think this would be a very good companion piece with Ballard's Crash, except it's probably more multifaceted in its approach. For instance, there's a whole section on oil, where he explores the geology of oil and then the social consequences and so on. So I think he ranges more widely over a car culture than you know, Ballard's more concentrated fiction.
Mm. And even thinking about Henry Ford at the end there, you know, and thinking about Henry Ford's legacy, not just in terms of, you know, the Ford motor car, but also, of course, his views and this kind of, this, you know, he, it's all kind of mixed up in one person. It's a very kind of, you know, a rather bleak kind of legacy. So the idea of death and murder there, but also, you know.
Yes, I mean, I suppose more play on words, the death drive is really in this poem.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, in a quite literal sense.
That sense of exhaustion as well, I think, I mean, that can...
No pun.
puns are go-go. You can link that back to the 19th century, late 19th century anxieties as well. I mean, I'm just looking at this earlier bit in the poem of the people saying to each other, oh, we had such an awful journey, I feel completely drained. Now, what was it you want to talk about? Mm. It just kind of... There was that worry, wasn't there, even with earlier modes of transportation, that the physical... effects and the sort of mental exhaustion that would result from being buffeted and being you know, sort of shunted around in these, and I think that sense, even though obviously this is much later, you know, you do find that in those 19th century poems about trains and things.
And we get this today, don't we, with mobile phones, with the internet, the idea that it has a psychological impact. And yeah, I was just looking at an earlier section where he talks about television. He says, oh, like television, the peculiar rhythm of the car sucks the brainwaves into an artificial resonance, a managed and manageable attention span, the TV of travel. Mm. And again, that idea of, you know, this is going to change the way our brains work, you know, the kind of the exhilaration of the car, but also the experience of travelling in this new mode of transport is going to change us.
Yeah, it's not very so wiring. Relevant with the environmental concerns as well, obviously, all the reports about... the way that this affects people's lungs and things. I mean, it seems so current still.
Yes. I mean, this, I suppose, inaugurated, I think, in Williams's writing, an engagement with larger environmental questions, whereas before some of his political campaigning had been around issues of homelessness and topics like that, because the year after this, he published Whale Nation, which is also quite a well-known sort of long poem about, you know, that particular environmental casualty.
Mm.
And then Sacred Elephant the year after, sort of similarly, you know, grand in its ambition and so on. And yes, I suppose all of these poems are 30 years before Extinction Rebellion.
Well, that's it's really interesting and not very well known, I don't think, this long poem from the late 80s and then the early 90s published as a book. But something that definitely is worth seeking out in full, and because as you say, it's very multifaceted.
Yes.
Is there a Mad Max connection, or is that just me?
Well, again, you could put Mad Max on the same module, couldn't you?
We're now going to revisit one of our regular features, One from the Vaults, where we look at somebody from poetry's past who possibly doesn't get the recognition they deserve. Sometimes it's a guest to nominate somebody, but this time I brought along someone who I'd like to bang the drum for, who I think deserves far more recognition than she's got to date. And that is a poet called Hope Merlies, or Helen Hope Merlies, to give her her full name. She's also a fantasy novelist. She wrote a remarkable kind of 1920s fantasy novel called Lud in the Mist. But she was also a poet, and she was British. She was born to Scottish parents in England in 1887. She went to Cambridge. She studied at Cambridge. She studied under Jane Harrison, who was the noted classicist. They became very close friends, possibly more than friends. There's some speculation about the precise nature of their relationship. And they went to live in France together, and they were living in Paris just after the end of the First World War. And in spring 1919, Merlies wrote this remarkable poem, a long poem that she simply titled Paris, a poem, which was published a year later by Virginia Woolf and the Hogarth Press, Woolf's own publishing press. And it's a long poem. It's basically describing, quite fittingly for the topic of today's podcast, a journey around the French capital, beginning on the on a train in the Paris metro, and then following this narrator, this female flâneuse, we've got another flâneuse, around the city, and it follows her across the day, around Paris, taking in the sights, the sounds, the landmarks, capturing this kind of post-war mood. And it ends with the dawning of the next day, and the kind of the end, as it were, the fag end of the previous day, where people are falling out of the Moulin Rouge and getting in taxis to go home. So kind of there's a nice, as it were, a transport link there throughout the poem. But what I love about it is its style. It's very, very different from a lot of poetry being written in English in the 1910s, even after the end of the First World War. It's not just modernist, it's very avant-garde. It's very influenced by experimental French poetry that Merlies had come into contact with when she'd been living in Paris. So people like Guillaume Apollinaire and Jean Cocteau and Blaise Cendrars writing this really kind of, you know, just visually striking poetry on the page, almost kind of concrete poetry. And that's what you get in Merlies' poem, which is very difficult to convey on a podcast. But I thought I might read just the first few lines of it, because I say written in English, but what's great about it is it's you know, it's very much an international poem. It is about Paris as this city where people have come who maybe kind of don't feel they fit in elsewhere, to come to this very bohemian and progressive and open-minded city just after the end of the war. So this is the beginning of Paris. I want a hollow phrase. Nord-Sud, zigzag, Lion Noir, Cacao Blücher, black-figured vases in Etruscan tombs, Rue de Bac, de Bonnet, Solferino, de Bonnet, Chambre des Députés, Brekekeket, quarks, quarks, we are passing under the Seine, de Bonnet, the Scarlet Woman shouting Burr and deafening St. John at Patmos. Vous descendez, madame? So immediately you get French in there. You also get Dutch. You get Cacao Blücher, which is a Dutch drinking chocolate.
I thought you lost your mind for a minute there, Ollie, I must say.
But this is the thing. It starts with English, but then you get French. Mm. You know, Nord-Sud, the French, the name of the line on the Paris metro, like I suppose like the Northern Line on the tube. Then you get Cacao Blücher, a Dutch drinking chocolate. You get a reference to the Etruscan pass with the kind of parallel between the these vases in Etruscan tombs and the underground tunnels of the Paris metro. You know, so you kind of get the ancient and the modern combined. So it kind of really prefigures something like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. It's a long poem. It's about the same length, actually, but written 3 years before Eliot published The Wasteland, but very much mixing up past with present and ancient and modern, high culture and popular culture, and so you've got all these interesting juxtapositions going on. Lots of allusion as well. The notes are, you know, you really need notes to follow what's going on there, because there's so many references to French literature, to classical literature as well. Brekker Kekek Quarks Quarks is the most kind of, you know, kind of a striking part, I think, is from Aristophanes' The Frogs. And it's the chorus of the frogs in the underworld in Aristophanes' ancient Greek comedy. Mm-hmm. And of course, you've got the underworld, but then you've got the kind of underground of the metro, and they're kind of being juxtaposed. But you've also got frogs, of course, the idea that the old kind of racial slur, you know, of French people. So you've got lots and lots of things going on there in that allusion.
It's interesting because Levy's poem has those classical allusions as well, and she was a classicist and a Cambridge student so that kind of put the classical framework that is projected in both poems.
It's very interesting, isn't it, that, you know, in order to write about something that's really kind of modern and new and hasn't really been written about in poetry before, so many poets turn right the way back to the classical past, don't they, as a kind of way in to, well, I suppose, finding a kind of parallel, which is interesting because on the one hand they're trying to suggest this is very new and we haven't seen anything like this before, much like with Autogeddon, you know, the car is changing the way we think, the way we live our lives. But also at the same time maybe suggesting, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and the fact that this is actually just retreading old ground in some ways, and there are these, you know, deep links with, you know, thousands of years ago.
Or that such modern modes of transportation can be suitable topics along the lines of epic journeys.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, this is what's striking about Paris, I think, Merle's poem, because you get lots of the ingredients of the epic poem. So you get the descent into the underworld, which you often get in epic poems, but really it's just a descent into the Paris metro. You know, vous descendez, madame, you know, are you getting off here? You know, and you also get the epic battle that you often get in great epic poetry, but it's between the moon and the Virgin Mary, the kind of, as it were, the patron saint of Paris, you know, in Merle's poem, you know, Notre Dame and everything. So it's kind of brought down to a much kind of more local scale than you get in, you know, true epic poetry, but she's very much drawing on those, you know, that kind of language, those tropes, I suppose, of the epic.
Yes, I must admit, I'd have to confess my ignorance of Merle's as writer, but I really enjoyed that extract. I mean, are there signs of any significant revival of interest in her work, study of her work?
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, it was published by the Wolves in 1920, the Hogarth Press, but, you know, only 175 copies were printed. Once they sold out or just kind of disappeared, you know, there was no reprint of the poem. It was reprinted in very kind of excised, kind of modified form in the 1970s, but only in a Virginia Woolf journal. So again, very limited readership. And Merle's insisted on some bits being cut out because she'd converted to Catholicism later, after she wrote the poem, and she objected to some of the more kind of, as she thought, the sort of blasphemous or scandalous moments in the poem, because there are, you know, there are hints at things like lesbianism. There's talk of you know, it's broaching kind of more kind of I suppose sexual taboo sort of material in the poem, and so she cut a lot of that out when it was reprinted, and then that sank without trace really again. And it was only really in the last couple of decades when the late Julia Briggs kind of rediscovered it and researched the poem, wrote the very helpful notes that we now have on it, kind of really kind of tracking down, you know, what does photo midget mean? There's this line of photo midget, and you know, even Briggs kind of drew a blank on that one, you know, but presumably it was some kind of sign in Paris in 1919 for a shop or some kind of some kind of sign that was up somewhere. So Briggs kind of really sparked this resurgence of interest in it, and I've written a chapter on Merle's poem in my book on the Great War, the Wasteland and the Modernist Long Poem, out now in fine bookstores everywhere. But I place it alongside the Wasteland and, you know, look at, you know, how these ideas that feed into Eliot's poem were very much in the air elsewhere as well. And, you know, Merle's wrote in many ways the first great modernist long poem after the First World War, you know, taking modernist poetry to this new sort of ambitious height really of the of the long poem. And so there are a few of us working on her, but hopefully, you know, there'll be more and more to come in the future, because I think there's, you know, yeah, there are so many things you can say about it. There are so many things in there. There's, you know, questions to do with empire, to do with race, to do with gender, of course, and sexuality, but also, you know, the city and and the war, and the way the war kind of changed people's attitudes. And it's very different in Paris from how it is in the Wasteland. The Wasteland is very much kind of, you know, despair and about many aspects of modern life, whereas Paris is much more upbeat. Again, actually, I think using travel and transport as part of that, you know, the thrill of riding on the metro is much like Levy, you know, riding on the omnibus. And this idea of being able to observe the city, it's much more. To offer one more pun, it's a much more hopeful poem, we might say. but it's very interesting, because, you know, you place that next to the Wasteland and you think, well, actually, not everyone was full of this kind of existentialist despair, if you will, at the end of the First World War. People did see it as a, you know, despite everything that had happened, as an opportunity to, you know, make the world anew and to kind of move things forward. And so you get that real kind of energy in Merle's Paris. So yes, I think she needs to be raised out of the vaults and read by many more people than currently read her. I think she's great. Here's the part of the show where we look at a funny or alternative poem, or maybe a couple of poems, that could be interpreted as terrible or so bad that they're actually quite good. So for So Bad It's Good this time around, Andrew, you've brought along a couple of poems by somebody who is quite well known, but maybe not principally as a poet.
Yes, I'll be interested to see what you and Sarah make of these selections, because I think they do have sort of nice touching moments, but maybe also some elements of anti-climax and inadvertent comedy. Mm-hmm. So they're both poems by Henry David Thoreau, who you'll both know as a major American prose writer of the mid-19th century, very well known for a series of visionary and innovative texts that brought together autobiography, natural description, and political and social critique, and especially Walden, of course, in 1854, in which he reflected on his two earlier years of living in a cabin in the woods outside Concord in Massachusetts. I'm a fan of his prose writings. I've steeped myself in those quite a bit over the years, but came more recently to his poetry. In fact, I didn't appreciate until I suppose the recent past just how much poetry he'd written, but a lot of it tended to be almost jotted down. A lot of it appears in his journals. Sometimes the poems are very short, almost epigram-like, just a couple of lines, often without titles and so on. So it seemed to be a more informal part of his creativity, whereas the prose works like Walden, he worked on and gave them their eventual form. The poems seem more informal, perhaps spontaneous sort of efforts rather than work that he particularly prioritised. But I've got a couple of them here, and as I say, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, you may be enthused by them rather than sort of resisting them, but shall I give the first one?
Oh, yes, go on.
Okay, so this one is, I've heard my neighbours pump at night. I've heard my neighbours pump at night, long after Lyra sunk her light, as if it were a natural sound and proper utterance of the ground, perchance some bittern in a fen, or else the squeak of a meadow hen. I suppose we should say that the neighbours is a possessive form with the apostrophe there. It's not a plural noun. So I've heard my neighbours pump at night.
It does sound a bit dodgy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think it struggles personally speaking, to actually recover from that first line.
There's a real shift from the first to the second line, I think, isn't there? And the poeticism. And
who's Lyra?
Lyra's a constellation.
Mm. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Do hens squeak? That's my question. It seems a little odd, the squeaking hen that sticks with you when the poem's...
I mean, that is true, but I think probably it might be risky to actually challenge Thoreau's natural descriptions, because he did steep himself so much in the natural world. He was a great observer and listener and so on. So I think if it squeaks...
I consider myself schooled on the noises that hens make, but I think there's something about there's a ponderous mood, and then the sound of a squeaking hen is what you're left with.
Yeah, and also then just no full stop. It just, again, going back to what you're saying about jotting down these poems, it just kind of like you lost interest at that point. Oh, yes.
Maybe it was going to go somewhere. Maybe the hen was going to go on a journey, maybe a, transported hen.
Yes, well, I mean, if you do look at the pages of his journals, and quite a few of them have been published now, they are that mix of bits of description, noting what he'd seen, what he'd thought. Then you might have a few lines set out in poetic form, as I say, usually without a title, and then the prose might continue and so on. So there may well have been more prose after this rather than necessarily. Yeah.
So we shouldn't be too harsh, really, should we?
I think we can be.
Unconventional punctuation worked for Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
So.
Well, exactly,
I think some of them, with their very condensed nature, I think there is a slight Emily Dickinson quality to them, only without really the finesse, I think.
Yeah, and there's not enough death, I think, for Emily Dickinson there.
No.
She'd have to add a few.
So what's it about, really? Detail. I mean, is he annoyed that he's hearing this pumping at night?
I think that's, I think that is one of the potentially annoying things about the poem, that it actually begins with a material sound and a recognisable social situation with his neighbour, but he very quickly transfigures it into this scene of memory and a kind of natural idyll. And the poor neighbour, I think, gets completely, forgotten, left behind. And quite a lot of comment, of course, on Thoreau as a pretty difficult antisocial character, very much inward, quite difficult to get on with, and I'm not sure you'd have wanted to be his neighbour.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose they're thinking of that. The only way this would be really noteworthy is if it was when he was living in the woods, and it's like, hang on, I don't have any neighbours. Who's pumping?
Spooky.
Someone's moved in. Where's this hut come from?
Maybe just living in the woods, he, got used to the sound of just the nice birds and not the sound of people.
Well, that's it. It does very much give way to, as you say, to the natural world, to the birds.
Yes. Until if I remember correctly, there is a chapter in Walden called Neighbours, so it wasn't quite as self-sufficient in that sense. As
did he conclude that everybody needs good neighbours?
Did he pop in for a cup of sugar when you ran out in his
no,
cabin?
No, but I've long tried to see whether it was true or not, because although there might be the image of him living miles from civilization when he was in Walden, it was only a couple of miles from Concord and so on, so it wasn't on the far fringes, unlike his Main Woods book later on, where he really was in an isolated terrain. And whether it's true or not, I mean, it's such a good story that it has to be true. Tales that he used to take his washing home to Ralph Waldo Emerson's wife. And because, Emerson, as you know, was his intellectual patron and supporter. But whether or not that's true, I'm not sure. But it should be, shouldn't it, really?
Like a student going home at the weekend with their dirty washing. And you've also got another poem that you...
Yes, I have. This is a rather longer one. And again, I'll be intrigued for your responses. So this is called I Am the Little Irish Boy, which I think dates from around 1850. I am the little Irish boy that lives in the shanty. I am 4 years old today and shall soon be 21. I shall grow up and be a great man and shovel all day as hard as I can. Down in the deep cut where the men lived who made the railroad, for supper I have some potato and sometimes some bread, and then if it's cold I go right to bed. I lie on some straw under my father's coat, My mother does not cry, and my father does not scold, for I am a little Irish boy, and I'm 4 years old. Every day I go to school along the railroad. It was so cold it made me cry the day that it snowed. And if my feet ache, I do not mind the cold, for I am a little Irish boy, and I'm 4 years old. I mean, I don't know if that does strike you as a touching and poignant evocation of another marginalised group in the US at that point, or does it come across as a kind of off-cutting from the lyrical ballads? You know,
I mean, it's going pretty well until we suddenly go to, for supper, I have some potato. It's the construction of the line, though, really, isn't it?
Then if it's cold, I go right to bed. It's very kind of just mundane, and it's lost all sense of a kind of poetic voice. It's just, you know, it's almost back to his journals, isn't it? It's like he's transported that to the four-year-old Irish boy.
Yes, I think
he's keeping a journal too.
Yes, I think the subject of the Irish boy is interesting, because as you perhaps know, at that point in the mid 19th century, Irish immigrants were really subject to a lot of prejudice in the U.S. A very interesting historical study actually called "How the Irish Became White," because at this point, of course, they were biologically white, but in terms of their situation in the US, they were actually often categorized with African Americans and Native Americans, so subject to a lot of prejudice, reduced very often to laboring roles, such as this, sort of involved in the railroad. And Thoreau actually did write about Irish people that he knew a number of times. It sort of did so in Walden also. Some of those neighbours that he found were Irish. But even there, I think it's a bit problematical, because he can't help using the bog trope and so on, and ideas of primitivism and so on.
It's got potential, but it's like, it's kind of like a first draft. Like, I lie on some straw under my father's coat, and you think, is there going to be some insight into the hardship and the poverty, even the prejudice that they experience? But then it just goes straight, my mother does not cry, and it's kind of, what's happened to the rest of that? It's just the detail thrown in.
It's like ballady stanzas, kind of, but then they sort of break down, and that one certainly doesn't get completed. I don't know, what something goes wrong around railroad and snowed, and even though it sort of rhymes. I feel sorry for him, though, really, because I feel like these are drafts, and we're sitting here like it's a student's essay, saying, "Well, we've done that."
It's easy for us to judge, to pick holes.
We've analysed far worse crimes than these in this section.
Yes, we have, and as I'd say, I'm an enthusiast, I think, for his visionary prose, and so that's not going to be too deflected by looking at a couple of more rapidly written poems.
I feel like we're deciding whether to put him in room 101 or something.
But also, I mean, it is difficult to write in the voice, authentic voice of a four-year-old child is difficult, isn't it? Because you've got to get that innocence and that, you've got to get that across, but...
not mawkish, you don't want to
be exactly, mawkish. Or kind of facile and just, not really say it, not giving any deeper insight. That's the really hard thing, isn't it, about writing from the perspective of a child like this, is you don't want them to sound like they're 40, they're foregoing 40, but at the same time you do want to imbue it with some kind of deeper insight into the maybe the suffering or the prejudice and the kind of outsider status that they feel as immigrants, recent immigrants to the States.
Could I just touch on the railroad link as
I think that's thank you for bringing it back to transport.
Because I mean, you might remember in Walden, Thoreau is very savage about the railroad. He can hear the hooting of the trains, and it's presented very much as despoiling his wilderness and so on. But he does write quite touchingly in Walden about the people whose lives were taken involved in constructing the railroad, and he puns on sleepers. The railroad made of the sleepers, the casualties, the fatalities involved in constructing it. So here, the boy, later to be the man involved in railroad construction.
Kind of like navvies, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. And, I mean, if we'd had a Thoreau pro-transport poem, it would actually be about walking. I mean, that was his preferred mode of transport.
Yes. Back to Wordsworth again there as well. He preferred a good stride, didn't he, through the Lake District. Thank you for joining us for another episode of School of Poetry. We hope you've enjoyed listening, and thank you for joining us again, Andrew and Sarah.
Thank you.
Remember to hit the subscribe button on iTunes and recommend us to fellow poetry enthusiasts. And remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Loughborough English, where we'll be posting clips from the show for you to discuss. Next time, we have another Christmas special, so feel free to suggest any poems that capture the festive season for the right and, indeed, the wrong reasons. So thank you again for listening, and until next time, stay well-versed.